Hi there. This is Nick Savvides. You're listening to the NSavvides podcast. For those of you who just discovered the show, welcome aboard. This is a show where we talk about doing imaginative things, creative things, big picture kind of things, the kind of things that can only be done well with others. And that's what we talk about, doing collaborative things, creative things well with others. Our guest today is Jonathan Brilliant, quite a name. That's his actual name. Now, that would be quite an unfortunate name for an artist whose work was mediocre, not so good. You'd always have all that pressure to live up to the name. Fortunately, Jonathan's work is brilliant. He makes sculptures, installations that are unlike other sculptures that you've seen. I'm willing to put good money on that. He makes his installations from coffee stir sticks, that's right, thousands of them, into a breathtaking piece. And as it happens, there's a piece of his right here in beautiful Baton Rouge. How about that? But here's the thing. You're only going to get to see it until June 29th. That's not a lot of time, but you know, you got to move. That's what people do who listen to this podcast. It's not a podcast for people who say, oh, well, I'll get to it eventually someday later. No, I don't know. No. This is a show for people who take action. So if it sounds interesting, you got to go see it. You got about a week or so. All right. It's at the Louisiana Art and Science Museum. And the cool thing is, if you go on June 29th from 2 to 5, you actually get to see it come apart. It's an official event, the teardown, the red stick piece teardown. Now, building, great, but isn't it more fun to watch something fall apart? Yes. And this is an official event, so I would say now's your chance. All right? Okay, but this is a terrific conversation that we had with Jonathan. We talk about his work, about how a good part of what he does is collaborative, in that a big part of it is him doing the work, but inviting others, inviting the public to be a part of that, to witness it. And he does try to make adjustments in response to the space, to the unique layout of it. We talk a little bit about that, about how he works, inspiration for his work. But we also talk about some of the bigger questions. What is art? Is there such a thing as bad art? What's the point of it all? These are the kinds of conversations that I like having, but I don't always get to have them, certainly not with someone as distinguished as Jonathan Brilliant. It's the kind of conversation that we don't have a lot in our society, to be honest, but I think it's beneficial. You get to learn how an artist thinks, what he brings to the world, maybe what she brings to the world, and you get to say, how does this affect us? What is the value here? Are we better for it? Can we be better for it by experiencing it? Really intriguing conversations. You're not going to find these kind of conversations anywhere else. Well, I mean, because I'm not having them. They might be perfectly informative, but, you know, they're going to miss that certain something that I bring, whatever it is. I don't know. You have to stick around to find out. All right. I'm just kidding around a little bit. Please don't write any letter to your art society of choice saying, oh, do you know what I heard in this appalling podcast about all night? There are other interesting, exceptional, informative conversations about art happening elsewhere. It's just not happening on the NSavvides podcast. So it's a little different there. Okay. So we got all that. Hopefully you have some reason to stick around. I just want to tell you one thing. I do apologize for the audio quality. Sometimes it's not as good as I'd like it to be. We were trying a new way of recording the show that I had heard good things about. Didn't work out so well. And we had some drops on the audio side from Jonathan's end. I did my best to clean it up as best I could. There are still little bumps here and there, but I think overall the content makes it worthwhile. So be a pal and give us the benefit of the doubt, would you? Or, you know, you could always help us fund a studio and you could help us fly in our guests and then this wouldn't happen. Just throwing that out there for all you benevolent, kind-hearted patrons of the arts. Okay, enough of that. Let's get the show started.
This is the NSavvides Podcast.
Hello. Welcome to the show, Jonathan Brilliant. One of the things that is really intriguing to me about your work is the reaction that people have. A lot of times with art, people have a polite clap or this bewildered look like, well, what am I supposed to do with this? But every time I've seen people reacting to your work, they have that, oh, wow, reaction. So I was wondering if there was a favorite reaction that you've come across for some of your installations.
One of the favorite things for me is sometimes I'll be standing there with the work and people will come in and say, okay, where's the show with the coffee shop stuff? Because when they see a finished piece that just looks like a giant piece of sculpture, they don't always recognize what it's made of at first. So I sort of like that illusion that it's somehow something grander than it is.
I know you've talked a lot about finding and working from the elements in your environment. Do you remember a moment in particular where you thought, hey, I spent a lot of time at coffee houses. I think I could make something work out of these things.
What I did was I reduced myself down to only what I could find. And then by default, it became, oh, well, the place that I go to make drawings, that I spend time where I'd already been sort of saving coffee cups leaves and saving those materials, thinking I would do something with them.
One day these shall become works of art, something like that.
Or more like, you know, the coffee cup sleeves, it was more to the point that when I took coffee cup sleeves off of the coffee cups, they reminded me of larger scale sculptures on their own. So I just thought the shapes were interesting. But when I decided I should be a British artist, well, then it kind of all clicked together. Well, I should just take everything I can from a coffee shop. And then over the years, it's evolved. You know, it's just sort of the way that I make work. Of course, it's still going to be connected to the coffee shop, but more to do with the galleries and the places I'm working than any specific coffee shop.
Yeah, so as a spatial artist, you're doing these installations. It's not always a clear-cut kind of sense of success in the way that someone might measure music album sales or ticket sales. So how do you consider success for a particular piece? What makes you say, yeah, that was a successful installation?
I don't ever say that, really. I sort of say, oh, next time I'll get it right. Or I sort of, each time I do it, I kind of, once I start, I sort of know, like, oh, the next one, I'll do this. And so it's more that each subsequent piece kind of reflects what I learned in the previous one. And so, you know, to sort of track back, it's like things that I did last time affected what I did in Baton Rouge this time, you know, and especially with the integration of the sleeves. And it's funny, a lot of people see the cables that I use now and they think that's because I have to, but it's actually because I became really interested in the visual, the aesthetic, the look of the cables pulling things. I started using them when I had to suspend a piece a couple of years ago, and then I really found tensioning and suspending things literally and also just in the work. So it's more just that each piece kind of ticks into like, oh, okay, next time. The next big installation I have coming up this summer is also at a similar kind of museum where they have a planetarium attached. I don't know if you got to see the dome projection that they took, the time lapse. You see the dome one that was over by the planetarium when you were there?
You know, I heard about it, but I didn't see the that part of it. I saw the installation. And did they do like, did they actually put it in the planetarium?
Well, they did it just for the small dome outside the planetarium, but it was shot with the same sort of dome camera. But what it taught me was how that stuff was created. And this show this summer at this other place that has a planetarium, I'm going to deliberately build a piece over the camera so that both the piece itself will be kind of dome-like, but also now that I understand how the projections work, I'll kind of make something pop up. That will make a purposeful projection in the end too. So it's sort of that process. That's more for me is it feels successful as long as I still remain curious and ready to make another one. You're right, it's not something tangible like, oh, you know, it was finished on time and on budget, but that's just sort of a given. You know, when I sign a contract with a venue, they expect me to be able to create a piece in the given time, you know, but that's sort of a tricky word. I don't know, it's more that as I feel successful if I remain curious, you know?
Yeah, there you go. So adding new variations and reacting to what you see. I liked that you said that you were influenced a little bit by the Mississippi River, that view in that particular room as you were making the installation piece.
Yeah, actually, I'm glad you brought that up. That's one of those examples of remaining flexible, too, is when I was given the images of the space, they showed me it had images of the window. And in the early ideas for the wall drawing, it was just a muddy horizon line. Then when I got in there, it was so unbelievable, that sort of dappled light across the river. It was hard not to do something with that.
You know, Jonathan, another thing about your work that is intriguing to me is that you're taking something essentially disposable and making it memorable. And so I wonder if you thought, is it the energy that you put into it, the time that you put into it, the idea behind it that is captivating? What is it that is part of the appeal of what you do, you think?
For me?
No, for the audience. If most of us were to pass a coffee stir stick, most of the time, we would just dismiss it like, oh, I'm so used to it, I take it for granted, and it's something that I'm going to use and throw away. And so I think it's intriguing to me to see you take those kind of materials, something essentially temporary, and make it into a sculpture, something that has shape, something that has the ability to inspire. So talk about that.
For me, it's more that part of the way that I make sculpture is relying on the transformative labor. And so part of the rules that I have in place, where if you notice, the sticks are just woven in place with tension, there's no adhesive used, the coffee cup sleeves are just stacked together. And when I use things like lids and straws and other stuff, it's what's called a neutral process. You know, I haven't destroyed or altered the material itself other than through the labor. If there is a magic trick in what I do, the magic is that I'm just using the transformative power of labor. So I've just rearranged the same materials. And that for me is really important, you know? And I think that that's probably more relatable to people's experience with music. You know, an instrument looks very static on stage till someone picks it up and plays it and moves the strings around. So it's the same thing, that if you don't know how to activate the potential, but then you can still enjoy someone else's use of it.
Yeah, it's like your labor is bringing out the potential of what that material could be. I'm glad you mentioned music. I read you had a music background, and there's that quote from Goethe that architecture is frozen music. And I think what you're doing is sort of like architecture, maybe temporary forms in space, but it does have that sense of undulating rhythm, and it does have a musical quality to it as well.
That's just the default of working with systematic construction processes. Like things like weaving and stacking, they have their own built-in rhythm.
I saw the video where you're talking and your exhibit was coming apart a little bit. And I was, again, captivated by your attitude that, yes, it's going to come apart at a certain time, right? Some artists are very protective, like, oh, you know, we must glue this into place and freeze it into place. But I think there's something to be said about saying, hey, this is here for a time, it's transient, and then time will take its course and it may come apart. And you had this casualness about that, as if like, yes, of course, why would it not be any other way?
Well, and that's also, that video is from 5 or 6 years ago. I was in a very different place then. But yeah, always the...
Okay. But, so now you're like, I must preserve it, right?
No, completely different. I'm still the same way, but that... I'm not explaining. Like, things like that are just happening while it's being built. But always the intention of the work for me was to create large temporary installations, because if things are like that are permanent, they start to fade into the background. They sort of become wallpaper, and people almost forget that they're there. And so the idea of creating something that's very much an experience that you have to go down and see in person was always important to me. And then the other part is just the practicality of it. To preserve something at such a large, ridiculous scale is a whole nother logistical nightmare, versus just getting it made and presenting it is a really easy thing to do, I guess. When something is temporary and people know that it's not going to be there forever, it almost becomes more precious. And then when they return to the space where it was, it's like the memory becomes bigger. It becomes like the big fish story. They're like, oh, did you see that thing? Whereas like, someone to it and show them the actual thing, it's almost anticlimactic. But in a year or two, when people return to that museum, like, where's that piece with the, and, oh, that's gone, that's not there anymore, like, it almost makes it bigger and better, because it's, they have to remember it.
Yeah, I mean, it, not unlike our experience with life, actually. And I think you're right. I mean, there are some statues that I've seen where I remember thinking, wow, interesting statue. And then I walk past it, and then I, at a certain point, I take it for granted. So yeah, I guess if it is there for just a short time, you do remember it. And when it leaves, it makes just as much of an impression, I guess.
Yeah, more so. And in fact, when I show up somewhere, when people, especially now that people know what I do and what to expect, you know, early on it was a little complicated, but now there's sort of this expectation that in a sense, if you invite me somewhere to work inside your space, I'll do the best I can to make the hardest thing I know how to make. And you know, years ago that was a tricky thing to, but now people understand what they're asking for. So there's also this neat thing where you were talking about the audience. The audience members that get by when I'm installing have a very different experience, because sometimes they've never seen, you know, it's like the zoo effect. They've never seen species artist at work. And so
is that how you refer to yourself, species artist?
Sometimes, yeah. That's what it's like. It's like working in a zoo for artists.
But knock on the cage and they try to get you to eat the berries or something.
Yeah, they're trying to get me to sling my poo at the mirror. No, but the questions always are better for me, because it pushes me forward. It makes me think harder, because the audience oftentimes asks the best questions, the sort of the fundamental questions. A lot of artists just work alone or in isolation, or even, you know, larger installation artists work in private places and never have to answer for what they're doing. And what happens with me, because I work primarily in public, is I'm continually confronted both personally and also from the audience with the question of, like, why do this? Where did it start? You know, why keep doing this? You know, and that's sort of, I'm always like living in having a reason to keep making work, and I fall prey to feeling like there's no reason. But I quite enjoy, I guess what I'm saying, when I show up, like Baton Rouge is a good example. They had really built a lot of programming around the time that I was going to be there working, as well as, you know, the exhibition itself and other events and programming. So there was this really interesting dynamic where, and this happens sort of everywhere, that it's set up like this, where people are coming to see it, to see the magic trick. I joke, I call it a magic trick. It's not, in as much as Penn and Teller do the three ball and cup with clear cups. The only magic is that I show up and 12 hours a day and then come back the next day and do it again for, 7 or 8 days in a row, and then I leave.
You're putting in the time to bring out the potential, like
the not so fancy, or fancy term, depending on how Marxist you are, is the transformative power of labor. And that's,
yeah, well, I'm not very Marxist, so but that's fine. You can use your fancy Marxist terms if you're so inclined.
Well, I just, when I say it is the transformative power of labor, I like that sort of speaks a little bit to the magic. There's a lot of parables and stories about how, you know, a table goes from being something that's made by hand to becoming a commodity, and I'm sort of pulling the commodity out of circulation and declaring it something better. But I'm not the first and I'm not the last. And in fact, the sort of the artists that I look up to, and that's sort of the magic in the work they do, is they take materials that are already in circulation and then, through some sort of process, translate them, transform them into a new experience.
Yeah, I came across another installation you did based on temporary things. In this case, the fortune cookies, the Field of Good Fortune that you did. Oh, yeah. Pretty intriguing. Was there ever a fortune that you read that really impacted your life?
Yeah, occasionally you'll see it show up at large scale. It didn't impact my life. It's, but I like the fortune. There's one in my collection that says you have a keen sense of humor and love a good time. And I've used that one at different scales, but it's more now. I have so many thousands of fortunes in the collection that I index and categorize them by themes, so that as I redo the fortune project, sometimes I do them as yard signs now, sometimes they're large scale signs. I can pull out messages and themes that start to tell a narrative with found text. And that's sort of a fun thing. Like the Kendall College of Art and Design had me do a set of them for the Art Prize Festival last year. And so I pulled out all fortunes related to winning prizes, to things that commented on art. And I printed up about 200, what was it, 300? A couple hundred small like campaign yard signs, plus we had like 30 of the 12-foot fortunes. But the idea was that if you did start to read them all, there was sort of a cumulative effect of a message. But for me personally, no, I find the fortunes funny because they're like these little tiny prints, and I make prints of them too.
You'd think with all of the different fortunes out there, more of them would be bad, but they're mostly positive. Although one time I came across two fortune cookies in a row, which were kind of ominous. So that freaked me out a little bit.
They tend to be sarcastic, but also the thing that I've noticed in my collection is there's a definite change in the tone of them after September 11th. I can tell in my collection fortunes that predate September 11th, 2001, and the ones that come after it. Like, there was
really, that's fascinating. Yeah. I've never realized there was that change. So what's the difference?
Well, I've got a few that make direct reference to air travel and other things that I didn't see for a while after September 11th.
Oh, they're like no more X-nay on the travel light kind of thing.
Well, on things that referred to airplanes, and there were a couple other themes that I've known, and things about the economy and stock market and money and stuff tended to go away. But because I've just been gathering them, gosh, since before 2001, and I don't even eat Chinese food at all, really. I just I find them or people send them to me, or if I do go to like a Thai or a Vietnamese restaurant that gives out fortunes, I tend to skim all the ones that have been left behind on the tables and stuff by other people. So the collection just keeps building that way.
All right. So the fortune cookies themselves have not affected you. Do you think anyone has ever seen your blown up enlarged fortune cookie and possibly had a life-changing experience as a result?
The times I've done them, there have been some funny reactions. One of the times, there was a convenience store that sold lottery tickets, and I was out there. I was taking them down after the show closed, and the guy was like, oh, you know, I had a bunch of people playing the lucky numbers that were on the fortunes, and I told them they didn't give the artist a cut if they win anything. So I thought that was funny. Even at a ridiculously large scale, scanned in and blown up, people just were copying the numbers off of those to play the lot.
And they're like, it's a sign. The heavens are telling me something, right?
Yeah, no pun intended. They're literally signs. I mean, they're 12-foot signs.
Yeah.
And then the other fun fortune thing was last fall here in Raleigh, there were midterm elections. So I went, no official sanctuary. And I just kind of looked up the rules on campaign signs, and I printed up about 300 campaign signs of fortunes, but they were all related to like personality and ego and success and politics. And I went and stuck them up around all the campaign, next to any of the clusters of campaign yard signs around the city. And there were a couple funny little articles in the newspaper where people were trying to determine what campaign they were for, but it was just me, you know, having fun.
Right. Yeah. So people were thinking it was some kind of elaborate guerrilla campaign.
No.
They're trying to discredit us. They found out our secrets.
No, actually, the opposite. Political reporter was like, and, you know, several, you know, campaign signs with fortune cookie messages have appeared. So far, no one has taken credit or explained what thing. And then someone's like, oh, I think they're to do with education, or, you know, like, it was just funny. Predictably, people would assign extra meaning to them, but they really were just an art project. They were a perfect timing because during campaign times, you can put out campaign yard signs for so many days without any problems. And it was especially funny because when I put my links to the real campaign signs, it immediately became a comment on them. And I know there's pictures of them online.
Yeah, it's like they had some of their best analysts trying to figure out, what is the connection? Is this education? Is this healthcare? What is it?
Right.
I noticed your affinity for the fortune cookies when I saw your Twitter background, which I think you have a great name, a brilliant name even for Twitter. You are at Brilliant.
Yeah, I'm the only one.
Yes, yes. You know, I was going to try to stay away from Brilliant making reference to your work because I'm sure you get that a lot. But then I saw that you have a fascination for Brilliant Alabama, right? So it's almost like you're playing up on that. Like, yes, I am brilliant, doing brilliant work here in Brilliant Alabama, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, when you grow up with a name, you at first it's a burden, and then later in life becomes less of a burden. But the Brilliant Alabama thing just tickles me. I mean, it's just funny. I mean, because most people have the impulse to, if they see a town with their name or a sign with their name on it, to get a picture of it. It's just a bonus that it's such a that my last name is an adjective, so it's really unusual that there be a town or a street with my name on it. So.
Yes. Have you ever thought about doing a light installation in Brilliant, Alabama? And then you could actually educate people about the various meanings of Brilliant?
Not a light installation, but I have dreamed of, you know, if I ever got to the stage where I could draw people to a remote area, it would be fun to do something. For the last time we drove through there, I was like, you know, I should just take out a P.O. box here and have it forwarded to wherever I live, just so you could send mail to Brilliant at Brilliant. But that's about as far as I got with that.
You don't want to take it too far, so I gotcha.
No, I do want to take it too far, but it's just I'm only one person, and I can only do so. Like, it takes everything I have to keep this operation afloat in its current state.
Well, there was one tweet that you wrote that jumped out, so I wanted to ask you about it. You said, if art and culture critics were serious about their jobs, they would use the term yontastic, which was amusing to me. So, on that note, are there examples of art that you think are bad, are horrible, that people should stop doing them? Or are you someone who likes to give a participation trophy to everyone? Like, hey, you showed up, you tried, all right.
I don't know. I think I was just more joking that
you... Oh, sure. I know you were just kidding around, but
I was half serious. It was more, though, in the vein of, like, when critics write something sort of scathing or the other, sort of defend things that are boring, I guess I was saying. No, I'm a fan of anything, and because I'm so involved in behind the scenes and logistical things, my first impression when if I see a show or something that I don't immediately understand, I don't assume something wrong with the work. I assume something wrong with my understanding of it in the context. So... I'm excited just to see anything set up somewhere.
Yeah, I hear you. But there are some examples of art that I think are less admirable than others, in my opinion.
Like what? What's an example?
Well, funny you should ask. There was one piece in San Francisco, in the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, called The Blue Smudge by Mr. Mel Buckner. And it was a chalk drawing of an arch in blue. I'm open to a lot of different kinds of things, but it just felt like, okay, I don't know if I'd call that art. Perhaps it's more of a half-hearted attempt to get attention.
Right.
I don't know.
But are you familiar with Mel Buckner's larger body of work?
I'm not.
This is the complicated task of museums, is to provide context, because work that's made with a different intent, you know, Mel Buckner's got a huge body of work, and just seeing one piece pulled out, you know, in a group show or even in a museum setting, I could see museums are a complicated animal. The best way to see contemporary living artists' work is to see it in a living contemporary setting. Museums have a different task. You know, they're the archives, they're the keepers of the records. So, but I actually like Mel Buckner's work. I don't know that piece in particular, but I know other works from his body of work, and he's been influential, and he's certainly significant in context. So that's tricky. I think the museum, they may not have gotten the best piece from him, but...
Yeah, but at least for that piece, it seems like it's significant for the ideas behind it, as opposed to the effort or the talent on display.
You're almost on the right path. That group of artists that he's part of from the 60s were very much about celebrating the idea and not the execution. One of the few pieces of art I have on my desk where I work, hanging above it, is a postcard of a Lawrence Weiner piece. It's just a text in a box that says, "The piece need not be made." But sort of the mantra of those guys from the 60s. But I mean, not seeing that specific piece, I can't speak to it, but I'm definitely a fan of work that favors both kinds of work. Work that is, you know, aesthetically pure and expressive, but also work that completely favors the head and the idea over the execution. They both work for me, you know?
All right, fair enough. And I will say it works for me in some cases. It didn't work in that instance. But yeah, I mean, I think there's something to be said about, on occasion, challenging something and saying, hey, I don't know about the merit of this, and at least having the discussion and saying, well, what is the value of
100%.
This?
100%. No person, human being, or viewer should feel that their gut reaction to a work is wrong, because not all work is for everybody. I mean, it's the same with music. In fact, it's interesting. Music gets a pass more often than not. It's so infrequent that people will say, oh, that's not music. They'll just say, yeah, it's not for me. But with art, I think people don't understand that it's just like music. There is a large variety. And just because one type doesn't work for you, you know, you don't have to dismiss it from the category. But I think it's hard, because people think they need a pre-existing like knowledge set, I guess. But I would say, if all you've ever operated from is your gut, then trust your gut when you go to a, you know, museum or gallery. And that's, if this was discussion started about my work and my interaction with an audience, I always love both people in an audience who come in and say, oh, I've never seen work like this before, and I really enjoy this, and people who come in right away front-loaded and can pick apart every artist and art history reference that is, you know, is embedded in my work and can see all the things that it's derived from. Both those types of audiences enjoy it. You know what I mean? So I guess that's the best case scenario.
Someone who is influential in how I think about this a little bit was Leo Tolstoy. I really connected to his book, What is Art? And in that one, he takes on some really prominent artists at his time anyway. And he says, you know, what is the benefit? What is the purpose of this? Why are we doing this? Why are we putting this effort? And I have a quote of his that I connect to. I want to hear your thoughts on it. But he says, creating art is not as elevated a thing as many people guess, but certainly it is a useful and kind thing to do, especially if it brings people together and arouses kind feelings in them. So he is of the persuasion that art is more valuable if it brings some benefit to the people, if it makes them a little better after experiencing it. So I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that.
It's easy to pull that quote out of context, but absolutely. I think the best case scenario, especially in this day and age when there are plenty of other distractions and people certainly confuse the experience of viewing documentation with actually viewing work in person. I would say in this day and age, any work, whether it be a painting, a photograph, an installation, a drawing, a public a statue, whatever gets you out of the house to physically go look at something with your own eyes and then return to the screen, I would say is a worthwhile endeavor. He's writing in a different context where, again, art was always a social thing, but these days it's almost worse now. People assume that seeing documentation of something is the same as experiencing it in person. So yeah, I do think best case scenario, you put something out in the world, people are motivated to go out and see it together.
Has there ever been an instance where you saw something or heard something and you felt like you were affected for the worst after seeing it? I'll give you an example. There have been some films that I've seen that have had the kind of effect on me where I noticed afterwards I was angrier, I was more volatile, and it took me a day or two to realize, like, okay, that was odd. And then I'm like, oh yeah, I think that film had that kind of influence, a negative impact for me.
Yes. Once you said film, I can name one, and I saw it in a single screen art house theater the year it came out. It was Requiem for a Dream, and I've never wanted to see it again.
That was a tough film. Although, you know, that one, it's complicated because, I mean, that one has that kind of dissonant feel. But at the same time, you're also thinking like, man, I want to stay away from drugs, right? I mean, I don't think you see it and say, hey, I want to go and...
Well, that's how I only saw it the one time, and I can still discuss it as if I've just won. That's because that was Aronofsky,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, that
was
yes.
Aronofsky. Yeah, and that was his Steadicam, where the camera was mounted on the actor and was viewing them from in front. And that perspective, it predates, you know, selfies and all this crap where people hold cameras in front of them. And that movie was just so creepy because you were in people's face and a perspective was new for them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah,
deeply
definitely.
Deeply disturbing. I would never want to watch it again, but it was amazing. I'd recommend anyone to see it. I remember it being great.
Yeah, I mean, that one was one that... I'm glad that I saw it, but it was tough to get through,
yeah.
Certainly.
Well, that's a great work of art, though. That's like, that's the best, that's the ideal. You know, like, it was, you know, visually beautiful, and it had a style. And the music, I remember people were really, the music had the cello, the Cronus Quartet was maybe the music for it, or something crazy like that.
Yeah, Cronus Quartet was a part of it.
Yeah, and, you know, all that has resonance. And then the one that's about to come out that Linkletter did, those sort of things definitely do it for me. And then in terms of, like... visual art. I don't know. I continually have really nice experiences. There's a painting that hangs here in town in Raleigh at the Northcott Museum of Art, a portrait by Andrew Wyeth. Andrew Wyeth is the painter famous for Christina's World. There's a great little portrait of his of a sailor where he's, you know, it's done in the same tempera paint, but it's just a portrait of a sailor with a beard, and each hair is, you know, one little brush stroke, and it hangs in the portrait gallery here. And that one, I go back to that over and over again. It's the kind of one that makes me want to keep drawing, and it just hangs in the museum here. No extra contextual information. It just happens to be in the portrait gallery. It's just a really nice painting, and our museum happens to be free, so I feel like I own that painting. I can go to it and look at it anytime in a good way. It keeps bringing me back.
So those are works that have had an impact. The question initially was about whether you've seen anything that made you worse,
yeah,
that you felt like you wish you hadn't seen it. But there might not be anything like that.
Yeah, I don't know, just because I'm still feel new to art. Oh, what made me worse? I think like a bad show.
So there's no art that you would say... that was bad art. That is art that is not making a helpful or positive
impact. I'm a good and a bad audience member. If I really don't like something, I'm not going to stand there and rip it apart.
That's very considerate of you. Some critics will go out of their way to say, hey, that should not have existed. Roger Ebert wrote some very passionate film reviews about movies. He said they should absolutely not have existed. So yeah, some critics are more inclined to do that, but not everyone is. Fair enough. I got that.
I guess so. But I mean, I do. I want to answer it and say, but I can't remember last time I walked out on a concert. I've fallen asleep in concerts before. I guess that's as good as walking out.
So a little yontastic there, just not enough to be offensive to you.
I'm not sure what was motivating that tweet, just because I think I liked the phrase yontastic. But I think just because it's the easy critique right now everyone sort of makes, that as internet culture comes faster online and images, like I keep saying, documentation start to supplant people's experience of actual work. Work is getting slicker and blander and easier to look at.
So for you, it sounds like you do get a little irked or maybe disappointed by artists who play it safe.
Well, I don't take enough risks. I think I'm drawn to go out and either see things like at the museum and like our sculpture park here in town. They're just great, fun experiences. Or if I go to like single artist show at a commercial gallery, I'm not going to get excited when it's just stuff that I could see anywhere. Same rules that I put on myself, I'll put on others. It needs to be something that I can't experience anywhere else to go see it in person.
And that's actually not a bad definition of art, of something that can't be found elsewhere that's so personable, so specific to the person who made it or the place.
With any really good work, a picture shouldn't do it justice. You should show up and be like, wow, seeing the scale of it, seeing the color of it, it should be that much better. Like, that's what I do like viewer experiences. People time and time again tell me that my work looks better in person than it does in pictures, and I don't feel like they're insulting my documentation skills. I think that should be the case. They shouldn't be like, oh, I saw a picture, but now that I've seen it, I don't like it. I like that they're like, oh, the pictures really don't convey the scale. And like, that's how it should be. You know, pictures don't really convey the color and the smell. And when I mentioned that little painting that's the Andrew Wyeth painting in the museum, if you go look up a picture of it, you're gonna be like, meh. And if I saw a picture of it, I'd be like, oh, whatever. But because I've walked by it in person and it's a certain size and it's hanging at eye level, it makes me view it very differently.
What would you say the greatest misunderstanding is about the work you do?
I don't want to ruin it for people, but the greatest misunderstanding is that I'm obsessed with those materials per se. They confuse me as some sort of outsider obsessive, and it's actually the opposite. I only work with those materials when it's specific to that project. But people have this, they're like, oh, your house must be made of this. And it's like, I don't even have any, I'm not even sure if I have any sticks around the house. I have some sleeves around the house. I think that's one of those funny things where people are always surprised, you know, or if they come to see me in person, the storage space that I work out of is really just a storage space. That studio that's in that video doesn't exist anymore. That documentary is from about 5 or 6 years ago. So I think that people are always surprised at how it's just work. I'm only working on those pieces when it's time for a show.
Right, so it's almost like they're disappointed that you don't live in a like popsicle stick house, is that
yes,
what you're saying?
They're also disappointed that I'm not an obsessive coffee drinker, and that it's always a surprise to people that it was more an exercise and activity in, I really like making drawings in coffee shops. You know, I really like the idea of a British artist. How do I merge all this? Okay, you know, I'll approach this using the same methods and processes they used, apply that to a gallery. And then over the years, in a sense, the work's just been feeding itself, you know, and each subsequent show is the next piece. The actual physical making just becomes labor. A lot of the anxiety and the planning is just sort of done on paper in doodles on top of pictures of the space. Still, it always continues to surprise me, but also, you know, because I'm always presenting it somewhere new, it is always interesting to have to talk about how it got started. But if you had shown me the work I'm making now and shown it to me as a person that I am just, I don't know, 10 years ago and said I was going to have to figure out how to make that work, I wouldn't have known how to do it. You know, I didn't just wake up one morning and make that piece in Baton Rouge. That built things I learned, you know, from the very first time a piece fell apart to the first time I had to suspend it. So it's sort of like the pieces keep feeding on each other, but only when I work on them in a gallery.
You bring your experiences, your observations, your curiosities to all the new
right.
things
yeah.
you do. One last question
sure.
for you. Let's say your ideal collaborator is listening to the show. What would you want him or her to know about getting the best out of Jonathan Brilliant?
My ideal collaborator would be someone that has a technical skill that is outside of my realm of knowledge, but is open to. The ideal collaborator would be someone like my friend at home, who is this amazing, technically savvy video projection guy and does all kinds of tech support. But I understand enough of the basic software that I can pitch him a really funny, crazy idea, but I know enough about how his software works that he then is like, oh, I love your, you know, like I know how to suggest things that his technology can do, but I don't know how to make it do it, but I know enough about it. So that's the ideal collaborator, someone who's got a technology and they're not quite sure to activate it creatively, and vice versa. You know, I have certain skills that someone may want activate, and like, and he'll ask me to solve certain problems for him around his technology, I guess. So that would be the ideal collaborator, someone that wants to meet halfway, like put their chocolate in my peanut butter, put the peanut butter in the chocolate, you know.
And you have a delicious chocolate peanut butter
exactly.
sandwich when you two come together. All right. We'll put in the links for your work and people can check out your exhibit. It was an honor. Thanks for taking the time to chat and you have a great
day. Okay, cool. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye, Jonathan.
Bye-bye.
All right. That's our interview. Lots of captivating ideas in that. So I wanted to take some time and expand on some of them. First of all, I think Jonathan's discussion about his creative process could be good advice to any emerging artist. He's basically talking about how he is pursuing his curiosities and that he considers a project successful if he continues to find something to sustain that curiosity. And that strikes me as very practical advice about how to continue onward as an artist. Sometimes it's discouraging. We work hard on something. It's not appreciated or there's a negative comment, but finding a way to continue to pursue the things that are interesting to us as individuals is a
good advice, because artists are interesting for the unique perspectives, ideas, experiences, abilities that they bring to the table. We take interest in a Picasso because it's unlike another painting. It's not a Rembrandt. It's not a Michelangelo painting. As an audience member, I'm not so interested in seeing someone do a second-rate Hitchcock or, God forbid, Tarantino. I want to see an individual take. And that kind of thing happens by practice, but also by refining one's curiosities, continuing to seek that out, as Jonathan discussed. Another thing that we touched upon was the notion of bad art. Is it possible for such a thing to exist, or is any artistic endeavor worth celebrating just because? This is tricky territory because art can be difficult and even discouraging to produce consistently. So on the one hand, we want to be sympathetic towards those who are making an effort to contribute something artistic. But on the other hand, there are limited resources. There's limited time and money. If a piece gets into a museum, that's less space for other pieces to get in. That's less money for other artists. So I do think there is something to be said about looking at art critically and questioning its value. I mentioned the piece by Mel Bochner that I saw in San Francisco as an example of something that I did not like, that I consider bad art. The artists in museums are getting paid usually a substantial amount of money to be in that museum. That museum is subsidized, at least in part, by the public, by tax donations that go to it or other cultural institutions. And again, if an artist is there, that's resources that is going to him or her and not someone else. So I think it's only fair to call to question the individual works and to say, does this piece of art of itself represent something of merit that we want to support? For Mel Bochner's Blue Smudge, I would say no. I would not have wanted my tax dollars going to pay for it. But beyond that, it seems like part of it in the art world is about knowing the ideas behind the art. There's an important difference between ideas that are discussed in the art and ideas that you need to bring to the art to appreciate it. You might see a play or a film on war that has various ideas about what is war, why do we fight. Those things are valid to the piece itself. But there's a school of thought that says, well, even if you don't know, even if there's no way that you could get some sense of the idea that is being considered just by seeing the work, that you should somehow know what was intended by doing additional research, by following up on the artist's statements, and that is necessary to evaluating the work. I take issue with that a little bit, and to explain, I want to reference Jean-Jacques Rousseau. For those not familiar, Rousseau was an influential philosopher during the Enlightenment. I'm going to simplify his ideas a little bit just for the sake of discussion. Forgive me, we might do a philosophy podcast some other day, but he has this notion of the noble savage, that people have a certain state of innocence, and then they encounter civilization, and civilization has a corrupting influence. I don't entirely buy into that. Again, complicated, I know, and I'm simplifying here. But in this case, it does relate. The uncorrupted man, the noble savage, would look at a lot of the pieces in a modern art museum and say, hey, I don't see art, I see trash. And in order to get past that, he has to go, or she has to go, and get extensive training, indoctrination into why, into the ideas, into the prestige of it, and get to that appreciation through that education or corrupting influence, as Rousseau might say. And this is a little different from the art that was recognized in the past, right? Someone can walk into the Sistine Chapel and be in awe of it. Now, if you know the art history behind it, it's even more impressive
There's a whole story to it, to the way it unfolds. It is astonishing to learn how it was made, the traditions being followed, the symbols used, and so on. But even to the casual observer, it is a remarkable achievement. You could even say the same of a Picasso, that with certain modern artists, the reason they're there is because some intellectual had an idea, someone else liked that idea and said, oh, this idea of this thing is important, and it's then spread through things that are supposed to have civilizing influence. And you have then things like the blue smudge, I would argue. People see it. Normally, they would not say, ah, a work of art, magnificent. But it's the corrupting influence of these supposedly civilizing institutions that make society take notice and pay lots of money for it. That's an issue, I think. Okay, so we talked a little bit about bad art, about some of my thoughts on it, at least. Let's talk about meaningful art. I referenced Leo Tolstoy's book, What is Art?, in the discussion I had with Jonathan. And as I said, that's been an influential book in how I think about that question. As a reminder, Tolstoy is not just some hack. He's not just an angry critic. War and Peace and Anna Karenina are both classic examples of literature. So his comments have a certain weight. They're coming from an artist who has proven himself and who has endured the test of time thus far. But the point of his book, I would say, was that producing art can take so much time and effort, and since that's the case, it should have some kind of positive benefit on society, at least if society continues to support it in such an active way. When he wrote, he was thinking of the effort that goes into making a play or a symphony. Nowadays, that's even more true, exponentially so, when you think about the effort that goes into building a massive architectural structure or an elaborate, expensive movie. Tolstoy's fundamental question still applies, I think, which is, what is the purpose of doing this? Is there any benefit to it beyond sheer spectacle? And his argument is that, yes, it should have a purpose. It should bring some kind of benefit to people. Unfortunately, there are some artists who I've encountered who seem to only care about how the work benefits them. I suspect that these artists have an internal monologue that goes something like this. I'm creating so that I can win awards, so that others can tell me how amazing that I am, so that I can put these trophies in my house, and I can have a mausoleum with all my awards when I die. It seems like that is their only motivating influence. They certainly do not seem to care that they have caused despair to others. In some cases, me, right? In some cases, artists who I thought I admired caused me great despair with the kind of treatment that they offered to me. So it makes me question the why of what they created. If they really believed in the things that they said they believed in, or that their art suggested they believed in, you would think they would treat others differently. But if your only interest is in creating something that gives you awards so that you can fill up your mausoleum, you're not going to really care about how you treat people. That's not to say that horrible people can't make inspiring art. They can and do. It's just that if we're going to use the why behind the art as a way to evaluate its merits, then it's only fair to consider whether or not that artist was successful in extending the why beyond a specific piece of art. Tolstoy, it seems, achieved that. Towards the end of his life, he dedicated himself to living a life of simplicity and serving those less fortunate. Now, Tolstoy was no saint. Any fair-minded person could acknowledge as much, but there's a consistency in the struggles of his characters, in the wrestling of ideas, if you will, in his work, in his art, and in his life. it doesn't seem like he was writing War and Peace or Anna Karenina just to get money and acclaim and recognition at the local dinner parties. Say what you will about Tolstoy, he was not a fan of dinner parties. Just go back and look at the way that he juxtaposes dinner parties with the tragedies of war, all right? But anyway, through his art, we might even say, he struggled to become the person that he ultimately became. And that is, to me, a bigger artistic achievement than just doing something that gets acclaim or makes money for someone. We said earlier that an artist should try to encourage his or her own curiosities and to become someone unique in so doing. And at the same time, we're also talking about how art should be something that benefits others. It is a complicated thing. It's something worth wrestling with, trying to figure out that right balance, whatever it is. So let's bring it back and talk about Jonathan as an artist. He is someone who I do respect as an artist, not just because he's doing something that is engaging to him. He's following his own curiosities, but he's doing something that brings immediate awe and wonder. He could be doing accounting, but he's doing that. And I think our society is a little better for it, for what he does. The way that we see it, we walk past it, and it changes us, and it has an impact. We're having this conversation now, that's tangible, but there are also all the intangible ways that someone might walk past it, and they might just feel more inspired to do something significant, to work a little harder to bring life into something that might have otherwise been disposable, to make our short time on this earth count for something distinct. Let me close this discussion by bringing in one more quote about art from another reputable Russian artist, in this case, the Russian filmmaker Andrei Tarkovsky. He says, quote, "The artist exists because the world is not perfect. Art would be useless if the world were perfect, as man wouldn't look for harmony, but would simply live in it. Art is born out of an ill-designed world." Okay, so the idea there is that the artist is working in some way to complete an incomplete painting, to make the world better and harmonious in the way that it is currently not so. You know, I was thinking about this in context to what Jonathan was discussing about how some people would see the numbers that he made in his blown up lottery sculptures and how people would see it and find meaning or look for meaning. So it raises the question, do people connect to the giant fortune cookie sculptures because they are looking for meaning in their lives where there is none, or because it's a reminder that there is meaning to be found if we look and are open to the messages the universe sends us? The way you answer that will depend on how you see the world and our place in it, but it is a question worth asking, and that is what art does. It makes us ask these kinds of questions. Now, I've besmirched the questionable name of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art by questioning their selection of Mr. Buckner's Blue Smudge in their museum that is, at least in name, dedicated to displaying art. So I figured I would include one positive illustration from San Francisco just to show that I don't entirely loathe everything about the city and all of its occupants. A few weeks ago, an anonymous donor started hiding money, specifically $1,000, around San Francisco. He or she, we don't know, would tell others about it through Twitter on the Twitter account Hidden Cash. I see that as similar to Jonathan's giant fortune cookie sculptures. We are in awe of that. We're intrigued. Why would someone do that? How interesting, how thoughtful to try to make someone's day better by the surprise of finding a gift. It's that hidden prize. It's finding that secret hidden treasure, like in a video game or in a work of art. I would say that is a kind of artistic endeavor that he's doing. And again, do we connect because normally that doesn't happen because the world is inherently a cruel, vicious place, and it mostly leads to tragedy. So when this artificial concept comes along, we're in awe because it's so different, or because that's inherent to the universe, that there is something magical, you might say, that the universe actually does have little rewards hidden for us that we can find if we follow the right course, if we trust our hearts, try to do good, and so on. In any case, it makes us wonder. It makes us take note, think about our lives, think about the way we live our lives. And that's not a horrible definition for art in general. Now, some of this stuff might sound a little abstract, and it is, but it's something that I also think about as I'm working on my own project. I'm putting together a short film, Trench War, about a soldier battling PTSD. And it's the kind of thing that I'm going out to folks, trying to get them interested, trying to get them to support our crowdfunding campaign. And it's the kind of thing that I believe has potential, but it's not necessarily the kind of thing that we can say, yes, it's going to make its money back. That's the unfortunate reality for most short films. It's not just ours. So it's a matter of thinking, well, what is the value and how do we explain that to folks? So these are some of the things that have been on my mind. I'm grateful to Jonathan for having that conversation with me about art. It's given me the opportunity to flesh out some of my own ideas as I'm working on my own project. Okay, so those are my thoughts on art. What about yours? Are there examples of art that you consider bad? Are there examples of art that have affected you? I want to hear about that. Tell us in the comments or shoot me an email. podcast@ncivitis.com is the email for us. We'll be glad to hear from you. Now that you've had a chance to hear about Jonathan, I would encourage you to set aside a time on your calendar to go see his exhibit. Just a few days left. Teardown happens June 29th. I think I'll be there. And so if you can make it, we'll have an extended conversation about art and the things that inspire us and what we're working on. And there might be drinks and food involved. Who knows? We will see. But we'll find a way to do something fun if you can come out. So let me know if you're coming or just look for me there. Either way. The Teardown happens again at the Louisiana Art and Science Museum, June 29th, from 2 until 5. You know, there was only one time on my blog, the Encivitis blog, where I mentioned the Louisiana Art and Science Museum. And you know what? I think I'll include a link to it in the show notes, along with the link to the Blue Smudge piece, because why not? I think it adds to that discussion, the dilemma about whether there's a purpose behind the patterns, or it's just completely random. I don't know, but I think it's interesting. And maybe you will think it's interesting as well. If you like the show, would you take a moment to support us? Leave a nice comment, share it with friends. They will actually probably like you a little bit more if you share the show, to be honest. What can I say? Good things seem to happen to those who support the show, who come on as guests or do nice things for us. I don't know why. Recently, Brandon Oldenburg and Limbert Fabian, our friends from Moonbot who chatted a while ago, they just won a Ken Lyons Award. Very prestigious. Todd Henry, the author of Die Empty, who was on a few episodes ago, his book went on to get selected in the Amazon Best Of list for 2013 after he did the show. So that was another big plus. Maybe that kind of thing will happen to you. I don't know. No promises. I'm just saying good things do seem to happen to friends of our show. Conversely, if you've noticed that your life has taken a sour turn, it might be because maybe you're not so kind to the show. It's possible. It's possible. I'm just saying, I don't have any proof. This isn't based on any science or anything. But if you notice a tragic turn for the worse, if your life suddenly falls apart, ask yourself, is it because I am a conniving, duplicitous person who has become an enemy of the Encivitis podcast? If so, I don't know. Maybe try to make amends and see if your life gets better. All right. Music, once again, provided by Rob Coslow. Thanks so much for his song, True Gemini. Until next time, let's make our future collaborations be better collaborations. I don't know.
kind of wish I had a last name like Brilliant, but then I don't think I'd get much done. I'd just sit around and say, that was brilliant, brilliant. Yes, that's my name, and it is so. Brilliant, 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 brilliant. Okay. Brilliant. Yeah, I should probably delete that because otherwise no one would take my thoughts on art seriously. And I don't think I'll get more dinner party invitations. So, yeah, I think I will.